This is Idaho Matters on Boise State Public Radio News. I'm Tom Michael. We're connecting now with Mike Kaplan of Caldwell. The Canyon County resident has lived here for about 20 years, but today we're talking about the creative work he did more than 50 years ago. In 1968, he was part of the team working on the groundbreaking film 2001, A Space Odyssey. The science fiction film was visionary, and it vaulted its producer and director, Stanley Kubrick, into the pantheon of great film directors. 2001 was about a manned space journey to Jupiter, extraterrestrial life, and the artificial intelligence of a computer named HAL. The film at first received a mixed reaction, then Academy Award nominations, fame, and 52 years later, it's a film classic. Welcome, Mike.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to talk to you.
Mike, what was your role with 2001, A Space Odyssey?
Well, I was essentially became the marketing strategist. I became that point man for the film at the first premiere of the film in New York in 1968. No one had seen the film prior to that week, and it was met with an incredible amount of confusion and conflict among the critics and among the public as well, because it was a revolutionary work in that it was nonlinear. It ran for over 2 hours and 20 minutes, and there was only 22 minutes of dialogue in the entire film. It was a visual experience.
Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
What are you talking about, Hal?
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
You said non-linear and, I guess, non-verbal, not a lot of dialogue.
Exactly.
I think it was Martin Scorsese who said famously, half of a film is sound. So what was the sound? What did people hear?
They heard the sound of space, which was basically quiet, augmented by a brilliant use of classical and well-known pieces, including the Blue Danube Waltz.
Not the usual music score, Mike, but more just famous classical music pieces and those sound effects you're describing.
And the film took 5 years to make. So originally he had a score written by a very famous film composer, Alex North, and it was completed. And he just didn't feel it was right. And when he could have used it, but it would have made the film something completely different.
Okay, so you're, for all intents and purposes, the marketing director there. You're often in the room with Stanley Kubrick when big decisions are being made. Take us to that one day in New York City.
And we were brainstorming strategy on a daily basis, you know, almost 24/7, in this, what I call the war room, where the walls were filled with tear sheets from every publication that had written about the film and ad sizes, etc. So I can't remember exactly what we were talking about, but suddenly the president of MGM Records, Morton Nassiter, came in to play Stanley a piece of music. I didn't know anything about this, and it was an intended single record to capitalize on the phenomenon that 2001 was becoming. Although there had been discussions and rumors that the Beatles love the movie, particularly John Lennon. There's a famous John Lennon quote of, "I see 2001 every day," that they were going to write something. A difficult film to synthesize into any kind of single. So the head of MGM Records took it upon himself to see what he could come up with, and he played this demo for us in what I call the war room, and it was basically a bland kind of love song from the 50s. It was incredulous that someone could even come up with such a preposterous interpretation of anything to do with 2001, where the lyrics ended with "I'll still love you" in 2001. I mean, that was the level it was on. Stanley and I, we kept on looking at each other while this was playing, knowing this was just totally ridiculous and basically pathetic. He turned to Mort at the end of it, and he said, "Mort, I don't think this will work. Let's wait and see what the Beatles come up with," which was a very diplomatic and smart way of dismissing it without, you know, offending anyone. And so at that point, he turned to me and said, you write music, why don't you write something? Now, I had always kept my music private for various reasons, because of, it was a very personal creative exposure. And I had no idea that Stanley even knew that I wrote music. I had never spoken to him about it. We were very, you know, very close about movies and life and all kinds of things, but music had never come up. So I was flabbergasted that he even knew this. But at that point, I mean, I was just staggered by his suggestion. And I said, what I write are more standards. You know, I don't know what I could do. And that's when he gave me what I call the that's not good enough look, which is kind of, he had piercing eyes that would kind of penetrate you. And that look was basically saying, come on now, that answer's not good enough. Better come up with something better. And
Mike, there you are. You know, this film is just gaining fame. In fact, it becomes the top grossing film for that year, 1968. And suddenly you're charged with composing a hit single for it.
Right. I mean, Stanley said it to me, and he was throwing down the gauntlet, more or less.
So you're about to set out to compose kind of a non-traditional song. What were your contemporary inspirations for this?
Well, the one that I thought of the most was MacArthur Park, which was a 7-minute single that Richard Harris, the actor, sang, written by Jim Webb, which was, you know, symbolic, and we didn't quite know what the lyrics meant. The melody was very intrusive into your being, and it broke every kind of rule at that point of what a hit could be.
Well, let's listen to a segment of that. This is MacArthur Park with Richard Harris.
Someone left the cake out in the rain. I don't think that I can take it, 'cause it took so long to bake it, and I'll never have that recipe again.
You're right, an unusual song, but still near the top of the charts for a long time in 1968.
Right. It broke all records of what could be become a hit.
You have that all stewing in your brain. How did you go mm-hmm. about composing it?
That's the mystery of creation, Tom. I mean, I don't know.
We're speaking to Caldwell composer Mike Kaplan about how a song he wrote 52 years ago is now just getting published.
Well, I wrote the song, Stanley, and he said, great. He said, well, come out and play for me this weekend at the house. And he rented this big house on Long Island at that point. And okay, come out and play it. Let me hear it.
Okay, so here it is now. The great director gets to listen to your single and decide if he wants to use it as the single for 2001.
That's right. Naturally, I was on the edge because, again, it was a very personal thing that was being revealed. We went out there, and I was expecting that the song was going to be heard on a high-end sound system like it was when we heard it at the recording studio, and like the film was, had the highest technology at the time. I mean, he was a perfectionist, and everything connected with 2001 technically was on the highest level. We're in this room with a lot of windows facing Long Island Sound, and suddenly his daughter Anya comes in carrying this kind of small wooden Victrola from the 50s.
Wait, that doesn't sound like technical perfection.
It wasn't technical perfection. And that's what we were going to hear the single on. So we put it on, and it really sounded small and tinny, and small built-in speakers into this old wooden Victrola that came with the house. And I was just shattered. I mean, I was just shattered. Hearing this song, which had been mixed by an accomplished sound engineer, then we played it a second time, and he thanked me for it and said, "You know, can I pay you for it?" And I said, "Forget about it." And we drove back, and I was devastated.
So he rejected the song. Stanley Kubrick rejected the single that you presented him after two listens.
Right, two listens. And we never spoke about it again. That was it. I mean,
so this didn't affect your working relationship with him in this film?
Not at all. I mean, I accepted it. I mean, he was the great auteur.
So, Mike, you went kind of back to your day job. This composer part of you was kind of a secret side of you. And, you know, you rose to the challenge. You created a song, presented it, but you still continued on in your current role. That was it, right? The song goes back on the shelf. No one sees
it
again?
Song goes back on the shelf. I'm still working on 2001. And then he asked me to do Clockwork Orange after that. We were very friendly, remained friends throughout his life. And I just kind of buried it.
Let's talk about what happened most recently. There is a company, Wave Theory Records, that is now releasing this for the first time. Congratulations, Mike, after all these years, to have that single be released. Well, let's hear a little bit of that song now.
Pictures of motion glide, glide. Ocean of pictures glide. Watch the turnings of the spheres and glide.
There's a style that the singer Naomi Gardner uses that's maybe like a, I don't know, like a Nico with the Velvet Underground might be a good comparison, kind of a spoken word style of singing.
Several comments coming back, people that like, but they feel that her voice is very, they keep on talking about the 60s and about the voice being very strong, and the delivery of her lyrics are always legible, and that the spirit is very much of the time. I never thought of it in any of those ways, but I have heard that. So your reaction, Renico, is consistent.
We've been talking to Mike Kaplan about how a song he wrote 52 years ago is getting published, Wave Theory Records, 2001, A Garden of Personal Mirrors. Mike, it's been great talking with you.
Same here, Tom. A pleasure.
Up next, a look at what's new at Story Story Night in Boise. I'm Tom Michael, and you're in tune with Idaho Matters.